سافرني بإيديك سافر خلف الطابق شوق العينيك شوق اللي السكوت أعجبي بيك خط حدود الأعجاب شعوري ليك حبي ظاهر جنون حبك والله حبك فوق الخيال حبك والله
Welcome back. This is Voices of the Middle East, and I'm Gudar Zaktadari, your host. We are talking about Saudi Arabia, and as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, the topic of tonight is U.S.-Saudi relation, and the speakers that came for a symposium put together by Portland State University and King Saud University at Portland State Ballroom. Now we are going to another taped interview with Dr. Saleh Almani. He's a political scientist at King Saud University. His topic of this of a lecture at the symposium was structural changes in Saudi Arabia's relation with the United States. And I asked him to elaborate on the relation between two countries and how it is moving.
In your perspective, has there been any change in U.S. and American relation after the September 11 events?
Yes, absolutely. You know, the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States is a very old relationship. It goes back to about 70 years ago. And this relationship was based on oil, on economic interests and security interests, and also on educational interests. Oil was discovered in Saudi Arabia in the 30s by American oil companies. We have also relationship, education relationship. We have over 35,000 students who graduated from American universities. Most of them are in medicine, in education, in the media, in engineering, in different aspects of life. And this whole people who have attended universities in the United States, higher education in the United States, came during the past 50 years to this country. And learned greatly from this society and from the universities and from the environment they lived in American societies. And they went back with this knowledge and they applied this knowledge to different fields of development in the country, like building schools, like building roads, engineers, teaching at the universities, working in hospitals, and so on and so forth. And we feel that this is a very important aspect of the relationship between our two countries. It's not merely economic. We don't want to view our relationship with the United States or with America as just selling them oil and they are selling us goods and services. Although this is a very important aspect of it, there is more than $20 billion of trade relations between the two countries, and there are about 35,000 Americans living in Saudi Arabia. About 4,000 or 5,000 Saudis living in the United States. The human element, human interaction is very important. The level of education and the flow of people back and forth and flow of ideas, I think it's very important for the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia.
Let me expand on this question with regard to the specifics of the plan that is now known as Neoconservatives Plan for the Middle East and democratization. What is your opinion on the way it's being approached and the way it's being implemented?
You know, historically, America has always been a land of freedom and a land of opportunities, and it played an important role to the rest of the world, including the Middle East. But historically, America and the U.S. has always been viewed in our part of the world as being a liberal state, as being an aggressive state, an non-aggressive country. Now with the new conservative ideology is pushed by certain people in power in Washington and elsewhere, we find that there is an attempt to change the world forcefully. That means we will have, you know, what they're saying is that we will change you, make you more democratic, even if we invade your country and occupy your country. So I think this kind of logic cannot be accepted by anyone. You know, sure, everybody wants democracy and so on, but we want our own form of democracy. We want our own way of doing political participation, not necessarily in the American way, but there are different ways for political participation. You have to know also that our land has its own versions of political participation. This goes to historical roots. There was some sort of historical political participation, even in tribalistic societies and old societies. So we shouldn't really think of the world as being void, and here is a few ideological people who could carry the mantle of new ideology to the area. I think this reminds us of the Napoleonic period, when the French Revolution attempted to expand in the rest of Europe, with good intentions, but nonetheless there was this military involvement and intervention in other parts of the world under the guise of democracy and liberty and so on. So therefore we do not mind the call, but it has to be a peaceful call, not an offensive, not a militaristic call.
Continuing that subject, there were some discussions within the academia of the really goals and objectives, specifically how it relates to the war in Iraq and change of regime in Iraq. And it was mentioned that there might be a relation between Saudi oil dependency in the U.S. and trying to create an alternative. Have you done any research on that, and what is your opinion?
There is a possibility to this. I mean, a lot of people are saying that the war in Iraq wasn't really for regime change, it wasn't really for democracy, it was for oil. And I think this bear a fact, but the oil in Iraq now is very limited, the production is very limited. And then to bring back Iraq to a level, you have to think that Saudi Arabia has the largest reservoir of oil in the world, something like 25% of oil reservoir in the world, reserves in the world, is in Saudi Arabia. Secondly, comes Iraq and other countries as well. I think to have Iraq develop to the point that it would replace oil from Saudi Arabia, it will take billions and billions of dollars to develop this, and it will take some time, something like 6 to 8 years before they'll become compared to the level of Saudi Arabia now, right now. But there is another point that's not available in Iraq. Saudi Arabia has always had an excess capacity. They always had something between 2 to 3 million barrels per day that they can produce on a very short notice. While in Iraq, that doesn't have this excess capacity. And even if it does in the future, there will be so much huge population pressure in Iraq that would not allow it to have the oil needed outside the country. If they have excess capacity, they will always have it for within the country. So the demand within the country will take a huge portion, that it will not allow enough oil for export, as in the case of Saudi Arabia. In this regard, one has to remember that this excess capacity of production in Saudi Arabia has always allowed the country to, in cases of crisis like the wars, even the last war with Iraq, Saudi Arabia produced more oil and alleviated any potential increase in prices, whereby the consumers could continue to buy oil at reasonable prices. We find in one occasion in the 1990s, for example, the second Gulf War, excess capacity production of oil in Saudi Arabia resulted in saving the consumer countries something like $40 billion within 6 months.
We spoke about the U.S. dependency on Saudi oil. The other side of the coin that is being discussed is Saudi dependency on military aid from U.S. and there are some talks of cutting some of those relations or decreasing the level of dependency, the level of American involvement in military affairs in Saudi Arabia. What is your opinion on that?
Okay.
What is going on in Saudi Arabia?
Saudi Arabia buys a lot of weapons. This is the weapons and any armaments sold to Saudi Arabia is not an aid per se. It's sold vis-a-vis the arms that you sell to, or the U.S. sells to Israel or to Egypt. A huge portion of it is really aid, military aid. But the money, the arms sold to Saudi Arabia is not military aid. It's an arms sales. And Saudi Arabia spends like something like $8 billion a year, $8 billion a year on armaments and military spending. So it's helping, if you will, the market, the companies, the American companies that produce these systems, defensive systems. Saudi Arabia is not an aggressive state. It's always a defensive state. If you read the military doctrine of the country, it's always a defensive doctrine. And you have to also to keep in mind that we have a large area. We play a very strategic role. It's like a small continent, the country. So to defend the country is very important, as well as to defend the oil fields themselves. So we have in what we buy in America, it's really a substitute for an American projection of force in the region.
So I guess part of my question was the military presence, the American deployment of forces in Saudi Arabia as for consulting or for help with training and those kind of presence. Are they going to be stay at the same level or it's going to be decreased?
No, it's already being decreased. The military presence is being decreased, and we envision what we call an over-the-horizon presence of the United States forces, not on-land presence. So in a sense, we do want, there is a negative political, negative outcome of the presence of foreign troops in Saudi Arabia. You have to keep in mind that Saudi Arabia has historically never been occupied by a foreign power, never been colonized by an outside power. So therefore, any presence of foreign troops on its country normally creates some sort of a backlash. So in order to stop this backlash, in order to avoid it, it has always been advocated by Saudis, and I'm not talking here in terms of the government, I'm just a university professor, but the opinion has always been going that it's better for U.S. presence over the horizon to stabilize the balance of forces in the region, rather than the presence on land. The American presence is very important in the region. But the presence on the horizon is different than occupation. In a sense, we don't mind the American presence on the Gulf itself, on the fleet itself, but we mind the occupation and continued occupation of other lands, particularly in Iraq and elsewhere.
Let me ask you about the system inside Saudi Arabia. And there are, again, some news and reports and studies about the changes and reforms within the Saudi society. How do you see that in relation with this whole concept of democratization in the Middle East?
I think democratization in the Middle East is coming about, but it's in what form and at what level. What we are arguing is that we have to be evolutionist. We have to be evolutionary in terms of the change coming to play in the region. As you know, the government has already decided to hold municipal elections next year, in about 8 to 10 months from now. And there are also calls for elections at the national level. So, of course, this is a very positive development, and I think a lot of people are really eager to have these political development and a change in the region to the better.
And I guess when you were mentioning that there were at some point 30,000 to 35,000 Saudi students in the U.S. and people such as yourself, yeah, academia and the scholars who are going back. What is the share that you have, for example, as a university professor in political structures in Saudi Arabia? Is there mechanisms that you can voice your opinions on different issues?
Yes, I write personally, and some of my colleagues also write in the newspaper. For example, I write in the newspaper a weekly column in Saudi Arabia, and also a contributing writer in Abu Dhabi to Al Ittihad newspaper. So we do quite a bit of writing, and we write on politics and so on and so forth. Some of us also are employed part-time as consultant to different ministries within the kingdom. For example, I have engineers friends who work for the municipalities in a consultative fashion. Some of us work also consultative fashion to different companies working in the kingdom in Saudi Arabia. So we do play a very important role, whether in academia or also outside in the other societal forms, developing or helping our society in that regard. So we do this either in consultation or in ideas and thoughts.
Can you give me for last question, what is the role of the Shura? Who are basically the members of the Shura, and are they from outside the Saudi family or just consultants?
We have the Shura Council is made of about 120 members, none of them from the royal family. All of them have been appointed, and most of them are technocrats. Most of them have come from the university ranks. We have three of our colleagues here within our own group who came to the United States, who are also from the Shura Council. And now some of them are voicing dismay because they have to lose their jobs for an elected parliament very soon.
And what is the role of Shura? I mean, how much influence do they have in decision making?
The
consultative?
Yeah, the Shura Council is like a parliament, and they have about two or three readings of each law, and they have about, 11 or 12 committees once they debate the laws, the proposed laws, and once they adopt these laws, they send them to the Council of Ministers. And the Council of Ministers is the other branch of the legislative branch. And they have to. These laws will also be debated in the Council of Ministers. And sometimes they will be accepted by the Council of Ministers. If it's not accepted, it would go to the king. And he could have the say in the basic law. The Constitution says that the king can intervene if one of the bodies in the Majlis Shura, the Shura Council, adopts a certain law, and the Council of Ministers does not accept that law, then it goes back to the king, who could give a verdict one way or another on these proposed laws.
And what is the timeline for this Shura to be replaced with an elected assembly?
I think within 1 or 2 years, I presume, at least half of the Majlis Shura will be replaced by an elected people, by an elected group of people.
Thank you, Dr. Almani, for giving this interview.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And welcome back. This was an interview with Dr. Saleh Almani, a political scientist with King Saud University, who presented at the Symposium of Saudi-U.S. Relations at Portland State University on January 26th. I apologize for some audio difficulties we had with this recording. There were some background voice that couldn't clean it up. But anyhow, we're back to studio, and Dr. John Mandeville, professor of history and Middle East studies at Portland State, and an expert on Ottoman history and the peninsula. Let me continue with my question that I asked Dr. Mani about the changes in society in Saudi Arabia, and how do you see that impact the whole structure?
Well, let me put it this way. I arrived in Saudi Arabia as a small child, the family moved over there in 1948. And in 1948, there was in the Eastern Province one two-lane asphalt road that ran between two oil camps, and that was it in terms of roads. There were very separated, it seemed to me as a young kid, 10 or 12 different villages that had wells and so on that could support palm trees and the like. I read back now, and the life expectancy then was something in the neighborhood of 39 years or thereabouts. People walked around with trachoma and diseases. It's like night and day, I guess is what I'm trying to say. The changes in society are enormous, and it's reflected in the demands for political change.
Well, obviously, that's the fact, and that's the problem.
That's both a fact and a problem. You're right. And it's a problem especially beginning maybe 6 or 7 years ago when a number of reformists in Saudi Arabia decided to take matters into their own hands and began a clandestine underground organization, which eventually was ferreted out and driven into exile in London, and it still is there. This is as much a factor in the present reforms as the demands from the United States.
But I believe there are also some reform within the Saud family, and the portions of them that obviously have been Western educated, and they went back and they have brought some sort of ideas that they want to implement. And obviously there are some negotiation going on within the Saudi.
As Dr. Al-Mani pointed out, you're talking about in the 60s and 70s, anywhere from 10 to 15,000 a year students being sent to the United States because they had no colleges back then in the 60s and 70s or universities. Those are the people he's talking about right now. He's one of them. Mm-hmm. Hint Huthela is one of them that graduated from PSU. She was my student back in 71, I think it was. They are now in positions of leadership. They are the ones that want it to be a little more like where they had their education. And they're living in both worlds, actually. Many of them have homes here as well as in Saudi Arabia. These are the movers. These are the real movers, not the clandestine organization, right. Mashari up in London, but the people in the government who want a bigger say because they know they're better educated than the people that are making the decisions right now.
Well, you're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, and we have our phone lines open, and we can take very few phone calls if there's any questions. The number is 503-231-8187, and I am continuing our discussion about Saudi Arabia with Dr. John Mandeville, a very distinguished scholar of the region and specifically on Peninsula and Saudi Arabia. And it's a real pleasure and honor to talk to you, John. What are the really impacts of the whole environment, what is happening right now in the Middle East on Saudi Arabia and relation between Saudi Arabia? Saudi Arabia at some point of time was the sheikh of the Arab world.
Yes, so but also not very well respected. I mean, they were respected for their money. Mm-hmm. And that was about it. They were perceived, as they have always been, as being, it's sort of like in Oregon, east of the mountains. They're seen as ranchers. They're seen as cowboys. They're seen as not very well educated compared to Egyptians, say, and Syrians and Lebanese and Iraqis. They now have pretty clearly showed that they have a very large educated population and can hold their own in the Arab League with the old powers, Egypt and the rest. And it's not just because of money anymore. It's a combination of money. And friendship with the United States. Mm-hmm. Don't knock that. Right now, suddenly, out of nowhere, 120,000 armed soldiers from the United States take up residence in the middle of the Middle East and obviously intend to stay there for at least another 2 or 3 years. There's no question about that. Everybody has to adjust to that. Iran, most obviously. And right. You could tell me more about that than I could about you, to you on Iran. But, of course, Saudi Arabia also. Many of them, including Iran, breathed a sigh of relief when the Ba'athist regime was knocked out. Mm-hmm. No question. It was a dangerous regime because it was weak. They were prepared, it would seem, to do almost anything that they had less and less at their disposal as time went on. But they could have done anything. And it was a relief to get rid of that dictatorial military regime. But now the United States is there, and they're more calculating than the old Saddam Hussein regime was, irrational, uncalculating. And that's even more threatening. Nobody in the area knows what exactly is intended by the United States there. We say that we're only interested in democratizing Iraq. It can't be that. No one believes it can be as simple as that. Mm. Israel comes up constantly all over the Middle East, including Saudi Arabia. Is this only a cover to allow Israel to continue to hold on to all of its territory? Why is the United States declaring that amongst all the terrorists linked together with Qaeda and so on is Hezbollah, which is essentially a militia army of Lebanese who drove Israel out of Lebanon? There's no way that any Arab in the world is going to see Hezbollah as a terrorist organization. We can't tell what the United States is doing in the Middle East. And as a consequence, everyone is nervous and everyone is towing the line, publicly anyway, with the United States, and none perhaps more so than Saudi Arabia. It does pay off, though. The rest of the Arab world knows that Saudi Arabia is a, if you don't say lackey, then you say friend, I suppose. They know that the two countries are tightly wound together by mutual interest. And so they're more careful dealing with Saudi Arabia now.
Do you see any change in influence that Saudi Arabia had on the U.S. policy in the past?
No. No, I'm afraid not. U.S. policy has done its best to carry out whatever it wants to do, and occasionally adjusting that to make the Saudi government either look better publicly or feel better personally. But they've never tailored their policy to Saudi interests. They tailor only U.S. to U.S. policy and U.S. interests. So I don't see, how do you mean that they would?
I guess the relation and the kind of give and take between Saudis and U.S. in the past was more obvious than it is today.
Sure was. This is basically between CEOs of oil companies.
And right.
That was easy. Now it's become much more complicated. The people in the policy decision-making seats, Cheney, all the way down to Pearl and the rest, they have a larger vision of the world, which Saudi Arabia is only a small piece of, and it gets in the way of their vision. This is something that makes Saudi Arabia very nervous. So if you're saying U.S. Saudis are talking differently to each other, you bet they are. There are different people involved.
Yeah, but I also mean really the financial influence and the kind of intermingling of, you mentioned, CEOs of oil companies and the way like they were expanding in the U.S. market. Yeah. And now it appears that there are some, I don't want to say resistance, but there are some change of mind, and they're moving toward more toward Europe and investing in that market.
You're thinking of the latest gas concessions that were let out last week. Yes, all of the newest giant concessions allowed out by this, contracted out by Saudi Arabia last week, were signed with contracts to Lukoil in Russia, to Spain, to who else was there? China, yeah. The Chinese oil companies were there. They're diversifying. Of course they're diversifying. Yeah. They're nervous about the United States. They don't want to put all their eggs in one basket, namely us, because we can be threatening at times.
Right. Well, we are at the approximately 6:58, and we should close down. But again, as usual, it was a pleasure talking to you, Dr. Mandeville, and thank you very much for taking time and coming down, and hope to have another chance to talk again.
I hope so, too. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you, John. We're going to start a little piece of music. And
this is the Community Council.
And on that, I will have some announcements to make. First of all, on tomorrow there would be a lecture at Portland State. It's a presentation titled U.S. and Islamic Constitutionalism, a Comparative Overview. The speaker is Dr. Aziza Al-Hebri, Professor of Law, University of Richmond. It is happening at 7:30 tomorrow night at Room 228, which is the Multicultural Center at Smoot Memorial Student Union. On Saturday, there is an International Women's Day event by Iranian Women's Association of Oregon. Saturday, March 13 at 6 p.m. at Portland State, again at Multicultural Center, Smith Union Building. The keynote speaker is Ms. Homa Sarshar. She is the founder of Iranian Jewish Oral History Project. Next Tuesday, there is an Iranian New Year's, the eve of Red Wednesday, which in Farsi they call a Charshanba Suri. And this is the welcoming of Nowruz, which is the Iranian New Year's, will be next Friday. But this Tuesday event is March 16 from 6 to 11 p.m. at McManaman's Cornelius Pass Roadhouse. For more information, you can call Andisha Center at 503-998-6816. Next Saturday, the 20th, there would be a peace march anniversary of the Iraq War. And everybody is well invited to attend this peace march at Pioneer Courthouse Square, Saturday, March 20th. And thank you very much for listening. You can also log into the website for this program. It's www.voicesofthemiddleeast.com. And some previous program are online there. And this program also will be online very soon. Good night.